Question. Would you lie on the stand for Charles Manson? Answer. No. I would tell the truth on the stand. Question. So you would die for him, but not lie for him? Answer. That's right. Question. Do you feel that lying under oath is a more serious matter than dying, Brenda? Answer. I don't take dying all that seriously myself. All these witnesses were extremely antagonistic toward their real families. Sandra Good, for example, claimed that her father, a San Diego stockbroker, had disowned her, neglecting to mention that this was only after he had sent her thousands of dollars and was threatened by Manson if he didn't give her more. Manson had severed their umbilical cords while fastening one of his own, and throughout their testimony it showed. Even more than Squeaky and Brenda, Sandy rhapsodized on Manson's magical powers. She told the story of how Charlie had breathed on a dead bird and brought it back to life. I believe his voice could shatter this building if he so desired. Once he yelled, and a window broke. It was not until the penalty trial that the jury learned of the vigil of the family members on the corner of Temple and Broadway. Rather movingly, Sandy testified to life there. You can hardly see the sky most of the time for the smog. They are always digging. Every day there is a new project going. Something is always under construction. They are always ripping out something and putting something in, usually of a concrete nature. It is insane out there. It's madness, and the more I am out there, the more I feel this X. I am X'd out of it. After I declined to cross-examine Sandy, she very angrily asked, "Why didn't you ask me any questions?" "Because you said nothing which hurt the people's case, Sandy," I replied. "In fact, you helped it." I had anticipated that Sandy would testify that Manson wasn't even at Spawn Ranch at the time the murders had occurred. When she didn't, I knew the defense had decided to abandon the idea of using an alibi defense, which meant they had something else in mind. But what? Manson and the three female defendants had been allowed to return to court during the penalty phase. They were much quieter now, far more subdued, as if it had finally got through to them that this play, as Krenwinkel had characterized it, might cost them their lives. While Squeaky and the other Manson girls testified, their mentor looked thoughtful and pulled on his goatee, as if to say, "They're telling it like it is." The female witnesses wore their best clothes for the occasion. It was obvious that they were both proud and happy to be up there helping Charlie. The jurors shared a common expression, incredulity. Few even bothered to take notes. I suspected that all of them were mulling over the astonishing contrast. On the stand, the girls talked of love, music, and babies. Yet while the love and the music and the babies were going on, this same group was going out and butchering human beings. And to them, amazingly enough, there was no inconsistency, no conflict between love and murder. By February 4th, I was fairly sure, from the questions Kenrick had been asking the witnesses, that Manson was not going to take the stand. This was my biggest disappointment during the entire trial, that I wouldn't have the chance to break Charlie on cross-examination. That same day, our office learned that Charles Tex Watson had been returned to Los Angeles and ruled competent to stand trial. Only 3 days after his transfer to Atascadero, Watson had begun eating regular meals. Within a month, one of the psychiatrists who examined him wrote, "There is no evidence of abnormal behavior at the present time except his silence, which is purposeful and with reason." Another later noted, "Psychological testing gave a scatter pattern of responses inconsistent with any recognized form of mental illness." In short, Tex was faking it. All this information would be useful, I knew, if Tex tried to plead insanity during his trial, which was now scheduled to follow the current proceedings. Catherine Scher, a.k.a. Gypsy, was the defense's most effective liar. She was also, at 28, the oldest female member of the family. And of all its members, she had the most unusual background. She was born in Paris in 1942, her father a Hungarian violinist, her mother a German-Jewish refugee. Both parents, members of the French underground, committed suicide during the war. At 8, she was adopted and brought to the United States by an American family. Her adoptive mother, who was suffering from cancer, committed suicide when Catherine was 16. Her adoptive father, a psychologist, was blind. She cared for him until he remarried, at which time she left home. A graduate of Hollywood High School, she had attended college for 3 years, married, divorced a year later. A violin virtuoso since childhood, with an unusually beautiful singing voice, she had obtained work in a number of movies. It was on the set of one in Topanga Canyon that she became involved with Bobby Beausoleil, who had a minor role. About 2 months later, Beausoleil introduced her to Charles Manson. Though it was, on her part, love at first sight, she continued traveling with the Beausoleil menage for another 6 months before splitting for Spahn Ranch. Although she was an avowed communist when she joined the family, Manson soon convinced her that his dogma was ordained. Of all the girls, Paul Watkins had told me, Gypsy was most in love with Charlie. She was also the most eloquent in his defense. But though brighter and more articulate than most of the others, she too occasionally slipped up. "We are all facing the same sentence," she told the jury. "We are all in a gas chamber right here in L.A., a slow-acting one. The air is going away from us in every city. There is going to be no more air and no more water, and the food is dying. They are poisoning you. The food you were eating is poisoning you. There is going to be no more earth, no more trees. Man, especially white man, is killing this earth." "But those aren't Charles Manson's thoughts. Those are my thoughts," she quickly added. During her first day on the stand, Gypsy dropped no bombshells. She did try to rebut various parts of the trial testimony. She said that Leslie often went out and stole things to explain away the backhouse incident. She claimed that it was Linda who suggested stealing the $5,000. She also said that Linda didn't want Tanya and had dumped her on the family. It was not until her second day on the stand, on redirect by Kenrick, and immediately after Kenrick had asked to approach the witness and speak to her privately, that Gypsy suddenly came up with an alternative motive, one that was designed to clear Manson of any involvement in the murders. Gypsy claimed that it was Linda Kasabian, not Charles Manson, who had masterminded the Tate-LaBianca murders. "Linda was in love with Bobby Beausoleil," Gypsy said. "When Bobby was arrested for the Hinman murder, Linda proposed that the girls commit other murders which were similar to the Hinman slaying, in the belief that the police would connect the crimes, and realizing that Beausoleil was in custody when these other murders occurred, set him free." The copycat motive was, in itself, not a surprise. In fact, Aaron Stovitz had suggested it as one of several possible motives in his interview with the reporters from Rolling Stone. There was only one thing wrong with it. It wasn't true. But in an attempt to clear Manson and to cast doubt on the helter-skelter motive, the defense witnesses, starting with Gypsy, now began manufacturing their own bogus evidence. The scenario they had so belatedly fashioned was as transparent as it was self-serving. Gypsy claimed that on the afternoon of August 8, 1969, Linda explained the plan to her and asked her if she wanted to go along. Horrified, Gypsy instead fled to the mountains. When she returned, the murders had already occurred and Linda was gone. Gypsy further testified that Bobby Beausoleil was innocent of the Hinman murder. All he had done was drive a car belonging to Hinman. And Manson wasn't involved either. The Hinman murder had been committed by Linda, Sadie, and Leslie. Maxwell Keith quickly objected. At the bench, he told Judge Older, "It sounds to me like this girl is leading up to testimony of an admission by my client to her participation in the Hinman, Tate, and LaBianca murders. This is outrageous." The court: "I don't know if Mr. Kenrick has the faintest idea of what he wants to do." Fitzgerald: "I am afraid so." Kenrick: "I know exactly." Keith observed, I talked to this witness yesterday at the county jail about her testimony. It was sort of innocuous testimony regarding Leslie, and all of a sudden, boom, we are being bombed out of the courtroom. On cross-examination, I asked, "Isn't it true, Gypsy, that what you were trying to do is clear Charles Manson at the expense of Leslie and Sadie?" Answer, "I wouldn't say that. No, it isn't true." To destroy her credibility, I then impeached Gypsy with a number of inconsistent statements she had previously made. Only then did I return to the bogus motive. Gypsy had testified that immediately after hearing of the Tate-LaBianca murders, she was sure that Linda, Leslie, and Sadie were involved. I asked her, "If in your mind Linda, Sadie, and Leslie were somehow involved in the Tate-LaBianca murders, and Mr. Manson was innocent and had nothing to do with it, why haven't you come forward before today to tell the authorities about this conversation you had with Linda?" Answer, "I didn't want anything to do with it. I don't believe in coming to you at all." Earlier on cross-examination, Gypsy had admitted that she loved Manson, that she would willingly die for him. After reminding her of these statements, I said, "All right. And you believe he had nothing to do with these murders, right?" Answer, "Right." Question, "And yet you let him stay in jail all these months without coming forward with this valuable information?" Gypsy evaded a straight reply. Question, "When was the first time that you told anyone about this infamous conversation that you had with Linda when she asked you to go out and murder someone?" Answer, "Right here." Question, "Today?" Answer, "Uh-huh." Question, "So today, on the witness stand, was the first time that you decided to release all this valuable information, is that right?" Answer, "That's right." I had her. I could now argue to the jury that here's Manson, being tried for 7 counts of murder, and there's Gypsy, out on the corner of Temple and Broadway 24 hours a day since the start of the trial, a girl who loves Manson and would give her life for him, but who waits until well into the penalty trial, and on redirect at that, before she decides to tell anyone what she knows. At 6:01 a.m. on February 9, 1971, a monster earthquake shook most of Southern California. Measuring 6.5 on the Richter scale, it claimed 65 lives and caused millions of dollars worth of damage. I awoke, thinking the family was trying to break into our house. The jurors awoke to find water cascading on them from broken pipes above their rooms. The girls on the corner told reporters Charlie had caused the quake. Despite the disaster, court resumed at the usual time that morning, with Susan Atkins taking the stand to trigger an earthquake of her own. Day Shin's first question of his client was, "Susan, were you personally involved in the Tate and LaBianca homicides?" Susan, who was wearing a dark jumper and a white blouse and looking very little girlish, calmly replied, "Yes." Although by this time all counsel knew that the three girls intended to take the stand and confess, Fitzgerald having mentioned it in chambers nearly a week before, the jury and spectators were stunned. They looked at each other as if disbelieving what they had heard. Shin then took Susan through her background, her early religious years. "I sang in the church choir. The death of her mother from cancer. I couldn't understand why she died, and it hurt me. Her loss of faith, her problems with her father. My father kept telling me, 'You're going downhill,' so I just went downhill. Her experiences as a topless dancer in San Francisco. Her explanation for why she was carrying a gun when arrested in Oregon. I was afraid of snakes. And her introduction to drugs, Haight-Ashbury, and her first fateful meeting with Charles Manson." Returning to the crimes, she testified, "This whole thing started when I killed Gary Hinman, because he was going to hurt my love." Judge Older called the noon recess. Before leaving the stand, Susan turned toward me and said, "Look at it, Mr. Bugliosi. Your whole thing, man, is just gone. Your whole motive, it is so silly, so dumb." That afternoon, Sadie recited the newly revised version of how the Hinman murder went down. According to Susan, when Manson arrived at the Hinman residence to persuade Gary to sign over the pink slip on a car they had already purchased, Gary drew a gun on him. As Manson fled, Gary tried to shoot him in the back. I had no choice. He was going to hurt my love. I had my knife on me, and I ran at him, and I killed him. Bobby was taken to jail for something that I did. The holes in her story were a mile wide. I noted them for my cross-examination. After the arrest of Beausoleil, Susan testified, Linda proposed committing copycat murders, and she told me to get a knife and a change of clothes. She said these people in Beverly Hills had burned her for $1,000 for some new drug, MDA. Before leaving Spawn Ranch, Susan said, Linda gave me some LSD, and she gave Tex some STP. Linda issued all the directions that night. No one told Charlie where we were going or what we were going to do. Linda had been there before, so she knew where to go. Tex went crazy, shot Parent. Linda went inside the house. Linda gave me her knife. At this point in her narrative, Day Shin opened the blade of the buck knife and started to hand the knife to Susan. The court. Put that knife back the way it was. Shin. I only wanted to get the dimensions, Your Honor. Susan skipped ahead in her narrative. She was holding Sharon Tate, and Tex came back and he looked at her and he said, Kill her. And I killed her. And I just stabbed her and she fell, and I stabbed her again. I don't know how many times I stabbed her. Sharon begged for the life of her baby, and I told her, Shut up. I don't want to hear it. Though Susan's words were horrifyingly chilling, her expression for the most part remained simple, even childlike. There was only one way to describe the contrast. It was incredibly obscene. In discussing the Hinman murder, Susan had placed Leslie Van Houten at the murder scene. There had never been any evidence whatsoever that Leslie was involved in the Hinman murder. In discussing the night the LaBiancas were killed, Susan made some additional changes in the cast of characters. Manson didn't go along, she said. Linda drove. Tex creepy-crawled the LaBianca residence. Linda instructed Tex, Katie, and Leslie what to do. Linda suggested killing the actor in Venice. And when they returned to Spawn Ranch, Charlie was there sleeping. Just as improbable was another of her fictional embellishments. She had implicated Manson in her conversation with me and in her testimony before the grand jury, she claimed, because I had promised her that if she did so, I would personally see that none of the defendants, including Manson, would receive the death penalty. The best refutation of this was that she had implicated Manson on the tape she made with Caballero days before our first meeting. Describing that meeting, Sadie said, Bugliosi walked in. I think he was dressed similar to the way he is dressed now. Gray suit, vest. Question. This was way back in 1969, right? Answer. Right. He looked a lot younger then. We'd all gone through a lot in the last 14 months. Shin then began questioning Susan about Shorty. I asked to approach the bench. Bugliosi. Your Honor, I can't believe what is going on here. He is talking about Shorty Shea now. Turning to Dave, I said, You are hurting yourself if you bring in other murders, and you are hurting the co-defendants. Older agreed and cautioned Shin to be extremely careful. I was worried that if Shin continued, the case might be reversed on appeal. What conceivable rationale could there be for having your client take the stand and confess to a murder with which she isn't even charged? Fitzgerald took over the direct. He asked Susan why the Tate victims were killed. Answer, because I believed it was right to get my brother out of jail, and I still believe it was right. Question. Miss Atkins, were any of these people killed as a result of any personal hate or animosity that you had toward them? Answer, no. Question, did you have any feeling toward them at all? Any emotional feeling toward any of these people? Sharon Tate, Wojtek Frakowski, Abigail Folger, Jay Sebring, Stephen Parent? Answer, I didn't know any of them. How could I have felt any emotion without knowing them? Fitzgerald asked Susan if she considered these mercy killings. Answer, no. As a matter of fact, I believe I told Sharon Tate I didn't have any mercy for her. Susan went on to explain that she knew what she was doing was right when I was doing it. She knew this because, when you do the right thing, it feels good. Question. How could it be right to kill somebody? Answer. How could it not be right when it is done with love? Question. Did you ever feel any remorse? Answer. Remorse? For doing what was right to me? Question. Did you ever feel sorry? Answer. Sorry for doing what was right to me. I have no guilt in me. Fitzgerald looked beaten. By bringing out her total lack of remorse, he had made it impossible for the defense to persuasively argue that she was capable of rehabilitation. We had reached a strange situation. Suddenly, in the penalty phase, long after the jury had found the four defendants guilty, I was, in a sense, having to prove Manson's guilt all over again. If I cross-examined too strenuously, it would appear that I did not feel that we had proven our case. If I eschewed cross-examination, there was the possibility of leaving a lingering doubt as to guilt, which, when it came time for their deliberations, could influence the jury's vote on penalty. Therefore, I had to proceed very carefully, as if trying to walk between raindrops. The defense, and specifically Irving Kenrick, had tried to plant such a doubt by providing an alternative to Helter Skelter. The copycat motive. Though I felt the testimony on this was thoroughly unconvincing, this didn't mean I could sit back and presume the jury would feel as I did. As an explanation for why she was lying to save him, it was important that I conclusively prove to the jury Susan Atkins' total commitment to Manson. At the start of my cross-examination, I asked her, "Sadie, do you believe Charles Manson is the second coming of Christ?" Answer, "Vince, I have seen Christ in so many people in the last 4 or 5 years, it is hard for me to say which one exactly is the second coming of Christ." I repeated the question. Answer, "I have thought about it. I have thought about it quite a bit. I have entertained the thought that he was Christ, yes. I don't know. Could be. If he is, wow, my goodness." After confronting her with her letter to Ronnie Howard, in which she stated, "If you can believe in the second coming of Christ, M is he who has come to save," I asked her, "Even now on the witness stand, Sadie, you think that maybe Charles Manson, the man over there who was playing with his hair, might be Jesus Christ?" Answer, "Maybe. I will leave it at that. Maybe yes, maybe no." I persisted until Susan admitted, "He represented a God to me that was so beautiful that I'd do anything for him." Question. "Even commit murder?" I asked instantly. Answer. "I'd do anything for God." Question. "Including murder?" I pressed. Answer. "That's right. If I believed it was right." Question. "And you murdered the 5 people at the Tate residence for your God, Manson, didn't you?" Susan paused, then said, "I murdered them for my God, Bobby Beausoleil." Question. "Oh, so you have 2 gods? Evasively, she replied, "There is only 1 God, and God is in all." Since Susan had now testified to these matters, the prosecution was able to use her prior inconsistent statements, including her grand jury testimony, for impeachment purposes. On cross-examination, I had Susan repeat the alleged reasons why they went to the Tate residence. Once she'd restated the copycat nonsense, I hit her with her statements regarding Helter Skelter's being the motive, made to me, to the grand jury, and in the Howard letter. I also brought out that she had told me and the grand jury that Manson had ordered the 7 Tate LaBianca murders, that Charlie had directed all their activities the second night, and that none of them had been on drugs either night. I then led her back through her scenario of the Hinman, Tate, and LaBianca murders, step by step, knowing she would slip up, which she did repeatedly. For example, I asked, "Where was Charles Manson when you stabbed Gary Hinman to death?" Answer, "He left. He left right after he cut Gary's ear." Having inadvertently admitted this, she quickly added that she had tried to sew up Hinman's ear. I then took her back again. Hinman drew a gun on Manson. Manson ran. Hinman started to shoot Manson. To protect her love, she stabbed Hinman to death. "Just when," I asked, "did she have time to play Florence Nightingale?" Susan further claimed that she didn't tell Manson that she had killed Hinman until after their arrest in the Barker raid. In other words, though she had lived with Manson from July to October 1969, she hadn't got around to mentioning this. That's right. Why? Because he never asked. She hadn't even told him she committed the Tate and LaBianca murders, she claimed. Nor, until 2 days ago, had she told anyone that Linda Kasabian masterminded the murders. Question. Between August 9th, 1969, and February 9th, 1971, how come you never told anyone that Linda was behind these murders? Answer. Because I didn't. It's that simple. Question. Did you tell anyone in the family that you committed all these murders? Answer. No. Question. If you told outsiders like Ronnie Howard and Virginia Graham, how come you didn't tell members of your own family, Sadie? Answer. Nothing needed to be said. What I did was what I did with those people, and that is what I did. Question. Just one of those things. 7 dead bodies. Answer. No big thing. I paused to let this incredible statement sink in before asking, "So killing 7 people is just business as usual. No big deal. Is that right, Sadie?" Answer. It wasn't at the time. It was just there to do. I asked her how she felt about the victims. She responded, "They didn't even look like people. I didn't relate to Sharon Tate as being anything but a store mannequin." Question. You have never heard a store mannequin talk, have you, Sadie? Answer. No, sir. But she just sounded like an IBM machine. She kept begging and pleading and pleading and begging, and I got sick of listening to her. So I stabbed her. Question. And the more she screamed, the more you stabbed, Sadie? Answer. Yes, so? Question. And you looked at her and you said, "Look, bitch, I have no mercy for you." Is that right, Sadie? Answer. That's right. That's what I said then. Bugliosi. No further questions. On Tuesday, February 16th, after lengthy discussions in chambers, Judge Older told the jury that he had decided to end the sequestration. Their surprise and elation were obvious. They had been locked up for over 8 months, the longest sequestration of any jury in American history. Though I remained worried about possible harassment from the family, most of the other reasons for the sequestration, such as mention of the Hinman murder, Susan Atkins' confession in the Los Angeles Times, her grand jury testimony, and so on, no longer existed since the jury heard this evidence when Sadie and the others took the stand. It was almost as if we had a new jury. When the 12 entered the box the next day, there were smiles on all their faces. I couldn't remember when I'd last seen them smiling. The smiles would not remain there long. Patricia Krenwinkel now took the stand to confess her part in the Tate and LaBianca homicides. An even more improbable witness than Susan Atkins, her testimony regarding the copycat motive was vague, nebulous, and almost devoid of supporting detail. The point in her taking the stand was to take the focus off Manson. Instead, like the other family members who had preceded her, she repeatedly highlighted his importance. For example, describing life at Spawn Ranch, she said, "We were just like wood nymphs and wood creatures. We would run through the woods with flowers in our hair, and Charlie would have a small flute." On the murder of Abigail Folger, "And I had a knife in my hands, and she took off running, and she ran. She ran out through the back door, one I never even touched. I mean, Nobody got fingerprints because I never touched that door. And I stabbed her, and I kept stabbing her. Question. What did you feel after you stabbed her? Answer. Nothing. I mean, like, what is there to describe? It was just there, and it's like it was right. On the murder of Rosemary LaBianca. According to Katie, she and Leslie took Rosemary LaBianca into the bedroom and were looking through the dresses in her closet when, hearing Lino scream, Rosemary grabbed a lamp and swung at them. On the mutilation of Lino LaBianca, after murdering Rosemary, Katie remembered seeing Lino lying on the floor in the living room. She flashed, "You won't be sending your son off to war," and, "I guess I put war on the man's chest, and then I guess I had a fork in my hands and I put it in his stomach, and I went and wrote on the walls." On cross-examination, I asked her, "When you were on top of Abigail Folger, plunging your knife into her body, was she screaming?" Answer, "Yes." Question, "And the more she screamed, the more you stabbed?" Answer, "I guess." Question, "Did it bother you when she screamed for her life?" Answer, "No." Katie testified that when she stabbed Abigail, she was really stabbing herself. My next question was rhetorical. "But you didn't bleed at all, did you, Katie? Just Abigail did, isn't that right?" The defense was contending, through these witnesses, that the words "political piggy," Hinman, "pig," Tate, and "death to pigs," LaBianca, were the clue which the killers felt would cause the police to link the three crimes. But when I'd asked Sadie why she'd written "political piggy" on the wall of the Hinman residence in the first place, she had no satisfactory answer. Nor could she tell me why, if these were to be copycat murders, she'd only written "pig" and not "political piggy" at Tate. Nor was Katie now able to give a convincing explanation as to why she'd written "Helter Skelter" on the LaBianca's refrigerator door. It was obvious that Maxwell Keith wasn't buying the copycat motive either. On redirect, he asked Katie, "The homicides at the Tate residence and the LaBianca residence had nothing to do, did they, with trying to get Bobby Beausoleil out of jail?" Answer, "Well, it's hard to explain. It was just a thought, and the thought came to be." Judge Older was becoming increasingly irritated with Kenrick. Repeatedly, he warned him that if he persisted in asking inadmissible questions, he would find him in contempt for the fifth time. Nor was he very happy with Day Shin. Shin had been observed passing a note from a spectator to Susan Atkins. The week before, the girls on the corner had been seen reading court transcripts which had Shin's name on them. Confronted with this by Older, Shin explained, "They borrowed them to look at them." The court. "I beg your pardon. Are you familiar with the publicity order in this case?" Shin admitted that he was. The court. "It appears to me, Mr. Shin, that you are not paying the slightest attention to the publicity order, and you haven't been for some time. I have felt in my own mind for a long, long time that the leak, and there is a leak, is you." Maxwell Keith very reluctantly called his client, Leslie Van Houten, to the stand. After taking her through her background, Keith asked to approach the bench. He told Older that his client was going to involve herself in the Hinman murder. He had discussed this with her for hours and hours, but to no avail. Once she began reciting her tale, the transparency of her fictions became obvious. According to Leslie, Mary Brunner was never at the Hinman residence, while both Charles Manson and Bobby Beausoleil left before the actual killing took place. It was Sadie, she said, who killed Gary. Though implicating herself in the Hinman murder, at least by her presence, Leslie did try to provide some mitigating circumstances for her involvement in the LaBianca murders. She claimed she knew nothing about the Tate murders, and that when she went along the next night, she had no idea where they were going or what they were going to do. The murder of Rosemary LaBianca was made to seem almost like self-defense. Only after Rosemary swung at her with the lamp did she take one of the knives, and Patricia had a knife, and we started stabbing and cutting up the lady. Question. Up to that time, did you have any intention of hurting anybody? Answer, no. Question, did you stab her after she appeared to be dead? Less. Answer, I don't know if it was before or after she was dead, but I stabbed her. I don't know if she was dead. She was lying there on the floor. Question, had you stabbed her at all before you saw her lying on the floor? Answer, I don't remember. Leslie's forgetting such things was almost as improbable as her claim that she hadn't mentioned the murders to Manson until they were in the desert. Very carefully, Keith tried to establish that Leslie had remorse for her acts. Question. Leslie, do you feel sorrow or shame or a sense of guilt for having participated in the death of Mrs. LaBianca? Answer. Pause. Question. Let me go one by one. Do you feel sorrowful about it? Sorry, unhappy. You could almost feel the chill in the courtroom when Leslie answered, sorry is only a five-letter word. It can't bring back anything. Question. I am trying, Leslie, to discover how you feel about it. Answer. What can I feel? It has happened. She is gone. Question. Do you wish that it hadn't happened? Answer. I never wish anything to be done over another way. That is a foolish thought. It never will happen that way. You can't undo something that is done. Question. Do you feel as if you wanted to cry for what happened? Answer. Cry? For her death? If I cry for death, it is for death itself. She is not the only person who has died. Question. Do you think about it from time to time? Answer. Only when I am in the courtroom. Through most of the trial, Leslie Van Houten had maintained her innocent little girl act. She'd dropped it now, the jury seeing for the first time how cold and unfeeling she really was. Another aspect of her real nature surfaced when Kenrick examined her. Angry and impatient at some of his questions, she snapped back hostile, sarcastic replies. With each spurt of venom, you could see the jurors drawing back, looking at her as if anew. Whatever sympathy she may have generated earlier was gone now. Even McBride no longer met her eyes. Leslie Van Houten had been found guilty of two homicides. I felt she deserved the death penalty for her very willing participation in those acts. But I didn't want the jury to vote death on the basis of a crime she didn't even commit. I told her attorney, Maxwell Keith, that I was willing to stipulate that Leslie was not at the Hinman residence. I mean, the jury is apt to think she was and hold it against your client, and I don't think that is right. Also, during cross-examination, I asked, did you tell anyone, prior to your testimony on the witness stand, that it was you who was along with Sadie and Bobby Beausoleil at Gary Hinman's house? Answer, I told Patricia about it. Question, actually, it was Mary Brunner who was inside the residence, not you. Isn't that correct? Answer, that is what you say. Although I was attempting to exonerate Leslie of any complicity in the Gary Hinman murder, I did the opposite when it came to the murder of Rosemary LaBianca. By the time I'd finished my cross-examination on this, Leslie had admitted that Rosemary might still have been alive when she stabbed her, and that she not only stabbed her in the buttocks and possibly the neck, but I could have done a couple on the back. As I'd later remind the jury, many of the back wounds were not post-mortem, while one, which severed Rosemary LaBianca's spine, would have been in and of itself fatal. As with Sadie and Katie, I emphasized the improbabilities in her copycat tale. For example, though she had testified that she was hopelessly in love with Bobby Beausoleil and became aware that these murders had been committed in an attempt to free him, I brought out that she hadn't even offered to testify in either of his trials, when her story, had it been true, could have resulted in his release. At this point, I decided to go on a fishing expedition. Though I had no definite knowledge that this was so, I strongly suspected that Leslie had told her first attorney, Marvin Part, the true story of these murders. I did know that Part had recorded her story, and, though I never heard the tape, I recalled part almost begging the judge to listen to it. Bugliosi, isn't it true, Leslie, that before the trial started you told someone that Charles Manson ordered these killings? Answer, I had a court-appointed attorney, Marvin Part, who was insistent on the fact that I was... Keith interrupted her, objecting that we were getting into the area of privileged communications. I noted to Judge Older that Leslie herself had mentioned Part by name and that she had the right to waive that privilege. Kenrick also objected, well aware of what I was hoping to bring out. Van Houten, Mr. Kenrick, will you shut up so I can answer his question? I had a court-appointed attorney by the name of Marvin Part. He had a lot of different thoughts, which were all his own, on how to get me off. He said he was going to make some tape recordings, and he told me the gist of what he wanted me to say. And I said it. Question. What did you tell Mr. Part? Answer. I don't remember. It was a long time ago. I asked her if she told Part that Manson had ordered these murders. Answer. Sure, I told him that. Did she tell Part that Manson was along the second night, and that when they stopped on Waverly Drive, Manson got out and entered the LaBianca house? After a number of evasive replies, Leslie angrily answered, Sure, I told him that. The court, we will take our recess at this time. Van Houten, Mr. Bugliosi, you are an evil man. Each of the family witnesses denied that Manson hated blacks, but in the light of what I'd recently learned, several put it in a very curious way. When Fitzgerald asked Squeaky, did he love the black man or did he hate him? She had replied, he loved them. He is his father. The black man is Charlie's father. Gypsy had testified, first of all, Charlie spent nearly all of his life in jail. So he got to know the black people very, very well. In fact, I mean, they were like his father, you know. Leslie had said something very similar, adding, if Charlie hated black people, he would hate himself. During a recess, I asked Manson, Charlie, was your father black? What? He seemed startled by the question. Yet whether because it was such a crazy idea or because I'd found out something he didn't want known, I couldn't tell. There was nothing evasive about his eventual response, however. He emphatically denied it. He seemed to be telling the truth. Yet I wondered. I still do. The next witness was no stranger to the stand. Brought back from New Hampshire at the request of Irving Kenrick, Linda Kasabian was again sworn. Fitzgerald, Keith, and Shin had opposed calling her. Kenrick should have listened to their advice, as Linda again came over so well that I didn't even cross-examine her. None of her previous testimony was shaken in the slightest. Linda, her husband, and their two children were living together on a small farm in New Hampshire. The footloose Bob Kasabian had turned out to be a pillar of strength, and I was pleased to hear that their marriage now seemed to be working. Ruth Ann Morehouse, a.k.a. Uish, age 20, who'd once told Danny DiCarlo she couldn't wait to get her first pig, repeated the now familiar refrain, Charlie was no leader. But the rattlesnakes liked him. He could play with them, and he could change old men into young men. Adding a few more fictional touches to the copycat motive, Uish claimed that Bobby Beausoleil was the father of Linda Kasabian's second child. I asked her, You would do anything to help Charles Manson and these three female defendants, wouldn't you, Uish? When she evaded a direct reply, I asked, You would even murder for them, wouldn't you? Answer, I could not take a life. Question, All right, let's talk about that, Uish. Do you know a girl by the name of Barbara Hoyt? On the advice of her attorney, Uish refused to answer any questions about the Hoyt murder attempt. By law, when a witness refuses to be cross-examined, that witness's entire testimony can be stricken. This was done in Uish's case. Easily the weirdest of all the witnesses was Steve Grogan, a.k.a. Clem, age 19. He spoke of the engrams on his brain, answered questions about his father by talking about his mother, and claimed that the real leader of the family was not Manson, but Pooh Bear, Mary Brunner's child by Manson. Kenrick complained at the bench that Older was smiling at Grogan's replies. Older responded, "I find nothing whatsoever funny about this witness, I can assure you. Why you would want to call him is beyond my comprehension, but that is up to you. No jury will ever believe this witness, I promise you that." The youth who beheaded Shorty Shea appeared to be a complete idiot. He grinned incessantly, made funny faces, and played with his beard even more than Manson. Yet it was more than partly role-playing, as several of his very careful replies indicated. Clem recalled accompanying Linda, Leslie, Sadie, Tex, and Katie one night in a car. He claimed that Linda had given them all LSD first, and he insisted that Manson was not along. But he was very careful not to say that this was the night of the LaBianca murders, to avoid implicating himself. Many of his responses were almost exact quotations from Manson. For example, when I asked him, "When did you join the family, Clem?" he replied, "When I was born of white skin." I also asked him, since it had been brought out on the direct examination, about his arrest in the Barker raid. "What had he been charged with?" I inquired. Answer, "I was arrested on a breach of promise." Question, "Breach of promise? Some girl you made a promise to, Clem, or what?" Answer, "It was a promise to return a truck on a certain date." Question, "Oh, I get it. Sometimes that is called Grand Theft Auto, too, isn't it, Clem?" The defense called their next witness, Vincent T. Bugliosi. At the bench, Fitzgerald admitted that this was an unusual situation. "On the other hand, in this case, Mr. Bugliosi has been an investigator as well as a prosecutor." Day Shin questioned me about my interview with Susan Atkins and her testimony before the grand jury. "Why did I feel Susan hadn't told the grand jury the whole truth?" he asked. I enumerated the reasons, noting, among other things, my belief that she had stabbed Sharon Tate. Question, "How did you come to that conclusion?" Answer, "She admitted it on the witness stand, Mr. Shin, for one thing. Also, she told Ronnie Howard and Virginia Graham that she stabbed Sharon Tate." Shin was trying to reinstate the deal in which the DA's office agreed not to seek the death penalty against Susan if she testified truthfully. As Older told him at the bench, Susan Atkins took the stand in this case under oath and testified that she was lying at the grand jury. If there'd been any agreement, that in itself would have been enough to negate it. Keith asked me if I had either heard the tape Leslie made with Part or discussed its contents with him. I replied that I had not. Kenrick's cross-examination went so far afield that Judge Older finally terminated it. Others who took the stand in succeeding days included Aaron Stovitz, Yvel Younger, former Los Angeles District Attorney and now California State Attorney General, attorneys Paul Caruso and Richard Caballero, and promoter Lawrence Schiller. Every aspect of the December 4, 1969 agreement, the taping of Atkins' account, the selling of her story, her grand jury testimony, and her firing of Caballero the day after her meeting with Manson was discussed. Shin's most strenuous cross-examination of the entire trial took place when he had Schiller on the stand. Shin wanted to know exactly how much Susan's story had earned and in which bank accounts every penny was. Shin was to receive Susan's share for representing her. During my cross-examination of these witnesses, I scored a number of significant points. I brought out through Caruso, for example, that during the December 4, 1969 meeting, he had stated that Susan Atkins probably wouldn't testify at the trial because of her fear of Manson. Kenrick, however, scored one of the biggest points, for the prosecution. In questioning Caballero, Atkins' former attorney, he asked, "What did Susan Atkins tell you about the language written in blood at these three homes?" Caballero, "I told you not to ask me that question, Irving." Apparently convinced that Caballero was hiding something favorable to his client, Kenrick repeated the question. Caballero sighed and said, "She told me that Charles Manson had wanted to bring on Helter Skelter, and it wasn't happening fast enough, and the use of the word pig was for the purpose of making them think that Negroes were committing these crimes, because the Panthers and people like that are the ones that used the name pig to mean the establishment, and that was the whole purpose of it, that Helter Skelter wasn't happening fast enough, and Charlie was going to bring on the ruination of the world, and this is why all the murders were committed. I asked you not to ask me these questions, Mr. Kenrick." Having failed abysmally in their attempt to sell the copycat motive, the defense now switched to a new tactic. They called a number of psychiatrists to the stand, hoping to establish that LSD had affected the minds of the three female defendants to the extent that they were not responsible for their acts. It was not a real defense, but it could be made to seem a mitigating circumstance which, unless thoroughly rebutted, might tip the scales in favor of life imprisonment. Their first witness, Dr. Andre Tweed, professed to be an expert on LSD, but almost all of his testimony was contrary to that of acknowledged experts in the field. Tweed claimed he knew of one case where a youth, while under LSD, heard voices which told him to kill his mother and his grandmother, and he did just that. On the basis of this single unidentified case, Tweed concluded that people may perform homicidal acts while under the influence of LSD. It was also his opinion, he said, that LSD probably caused brain damage. On cross-examination, I brought out that Dr. Tweed had only talked to Patricia Krenwinkel for 2 hours. He had not read the trial transcripts or interviewed any of her friends or relatives. He had never done any controlled research in the field of LSD, had only lectured once on the subject, and had written no papers on it. When I asked him why he considered himself an expert, he rather loftily replied, "What is an expert but what the beholder thinks he is from his experience? Many people consider me an expert, so I have accustomed myself to assuming that I am." Question: do you consider Dr. Thomas Ungerleiter of UCLA an expert in LSD? Answer: yes, I do. Question: more than yourself? Answer: I am not in a position to judge that. I will leave that to others. Question: do you consider Dr. Duke Fisher of UCLA an expert in the field of LSD? Answer: yes. I then brought out that the two men had written a paper entitled "The Problems of LSD in Emotional Disorders," in which they concluded that there is no scientific demonstrable evidence of organic brain damage caused by LSD. Tweed now had to admit that was correct, as far as present evidence went. On December 24, 1969, Patricia Krenwinkel had been examined by a Mobile, Alabama psychiatrist, a Dr. Claude Brown. Since Tweed had based his conclusions in part on Brown's report, I was given a copy of it just prior to my cross-examination. It was a bombshell, as my next question to Dr. Tweed indicated. Question: in forming your opinions with respect to Patricia Krenwinkel, did you take into consideration that she told Dr. Brown that on the night of the Tate murders, Charles Manson told her to go along with Tex Watson? After numerous objections and lengthy conferences at the bench, Dr. Tweed admitted that he had considered this. Still later, Patricia Krenwinkel was recalled to the stand, where though she denied the truth of the statement, she admitted that she had told Dr. Brown that this was so. We now had a perfect score. Manson had called Sadie, Katie, and Leslie to the stand in an attempt to exonerate him. Instead, I had now proven that each of the three had previously told others that Manson was behind these murders. There were other surprises in the Brown report. Krenwinkel also told the doctor that she had fled to Mobile because she was afraid of Manson finding her and killing her. Although harmful to Manson, this could only be helpful to Fitzgerald's client, Patricia Krenwinkel. However, it was not Fitzgerald who brought this out, but Keith, after Fitzgerald had concluded his examination. that on the day of the Tate murders, she was coming off an acid trip and wasn't on any drugs that night, and that following the murders, she was always fearful that they would be arrested for what they had done, but Charlie said nobody could touch us. This latter statement proved that Katie was well aware of the consequences of her acts. This was important, since it was obvious from their questions that the defense attorneys were trying to imply that the three female defendants were insane at the time they committed these murders. Under California law, an insanity plea must be entered before the start of the trial. A separate sanity phase is then held after the guilt trial. The defense, however, had not entered such a plea at the proper time. Therefore, in one sense, the question of whether the defendants were sane or insane was irrelevant, since this was not an issue which the jury would have to decide. In another sense, however, it was crucial. If the defense could cause the jury to doubt the sanity of the defendants, this could strongly influence their vote on the penalty they were to pay. Suddenly, I was not only having to prove Manson's guilt all over again, I was also having to prove that the girls were legally sane. In most states, including California, the legal test of insanity is the McNaughton Rule. Among other things, McNaughton provides that if a defendant, as a result of mental disease or defect, does not realize that what he did was wrong, then he is legally insane. It is not enough, however, that he personally believe his acts were not wrong. Were this so, every man would be a law unto himself. For instance, a man could rape a dozen women, say, "I don't think it's wrong to rape," and therefore evade criminal punishment. The clincher is whether he knows that society thinks his actions are wrong. If he does, then he cannot be legally insane. And deliberate acts to avoid detection, such as cutting telephone wires, eradicating prints, changing identities, disposing of incriminating evidence, constitute circumstantial evidence that the defendant knows society views his acts as wrong. Earlier, Dr. Tweed had testified that Patricia Krenwinkel didn't believe these murders were wrong. I now asked him on cross, "In your opinion, when Patricia Krenwinkel was committing these murders, did she believe that society thought it was wrong to do what she was doing?" Answer, "I believe so." Bugliosi, no further questions. On March 4th, Manson trimmed his beard to a neat fork and completely shaved his head because, he told newsmen, "I am the devil, and the devil always has a bald head." Interestingly enough, this time the three female defendants did not follow Manson's example, nor when he occasionally acted up in court did they parrot him, as they had in the guilt trial. Obviously it had got across to them, albeit belatedly, that such antics only proved Manson's domination. While denying that LSD can cause brain damage, the next witness, psychiatrist Keith Dittman, testified that the drug can have a detrimental effect on a person's personality. He also stated that a person using LSD is more susceptible to the influence of a second party, and that Leslie's use of the drug, plus Manson's influence over her, could have been significant factors in causing her to participate in a homicide. Van Houten, "This is all such a big lie. I was influenced by the war in Vietnam and TV." On cross-examination, I got Dittman to concede that not all people react the same to LSD, that it depends upon the personality structure of the person ingesting the drug. I then brought out that Dittman had never examined Leslie. Therefore, not knowing what her personality structure was, he couldn't say what effect, if any, LSD had on her mental state. Nor, turning this around, not having examined her, could he say for certain whether she did or did not have inherent homicidal tendencies. Keith, on redirect, asked Dittman, "What is meant by inherent homicidal tendencies?" Answer, "That a person has, let's say, more than the average human being, a killer instinct." Question, "Psychiatrically speaking, do some people have greater killer instincts than others, in your opinion?" Answer, "Well, some people have a more covert and overt hostility and aggression. In that sense, they are more capable of committing crimes of violence, such as murder." Dr. Dittman had just articulated one of the chief points of the final argument I was preparing to give at the close of the penalty phase. Dr. Joel Fort, the almost legendary hippie doctor of the hate, didn't look the part. The founder of the National Center for Solving Social and Health Problems was 40-ish, dressed conservatively, talked quietly, didn't have long hair. In fact, he was bald. Angered by his testimony, Manson shouted, "If he ever seen a hippie, it was in the street while he was driving by in his car." Manson's anger had good cause. Even on direct, Dr. Fort was more helpful to the prosecution than the defense. The author of one book on drugs and co-author of 11 others, Dr. Fort stated that a drug by itself does not perform a magical transformation. There are many other factors. On cross-examination, I brought out one. Fort said, "It was my feeling, after examining Leslie Van Houten, that Mr. Manson's influence played a very significant role in the commission of the murders." Another very crucial point came out on cross. To negate the defense's new argument that the girls were on LSD during the murders, and therefore less responsible for their acts, I asked Fort, "Isn't it true, doctor, that people under the influence of LSD do not tend to be violent?" Answer, "That is true." Still attacking the prosecution's theory of Manson's domination, Kenrick asked Fort, "Now, do you know of any cases where someone has, I mean other than in the Frankenstein type of picture, do you know where someone has sat down and programmed people to go out, let's say, and commit armed robberies, burglaries, assaults? Do you know of any such instances?" Answer, "Yes. In one sense, that is what we do when we program soldiers in a war. The Army uses a peer group technique and the patriotic ideals that are instilled in citizens of a particular country to bring about this pattern of behavior." Dr. Fort was typical of many persons who, though opposed to capital punishment in principle, felt that these murders were so savage and senseless, so totally lacking in mitigating circumstances, that justice demanded that these persons be sentenced to death. I learned this in a conversation with him in the hall outside court, in which he stated that he was extremely unhappy that he had been called to testify for the defense in this case. Greatly concerned about the stain the Manson family had cast on all young people, Dr. Fort offered to testify for the prosecution when I brought Charles Tex Watson to trial, an offer which I later accepted. It was in just such a hallway interview that I discovered how potentially damaging to the defense their next witness could be. Learning that Keith intended to call Dr. Joel Simon Hockman during the afternoon session, I cut my lunch hour short so I could spend a half hour interviewing the psychiatrist. To my amazement, I learned that Maxwell Keith hadn't even interviewed his own witness. He was calling him to the stand cold. Had he talked to him for just 5 minutes, Keith would never have called Hockman. For the doctor, who had interviewed Leslie, felt that the use of LSD wasn't an important influence on her. Rather, he felt there was something very seriously wrong with Leslie Van Houten. In his testimony and the psychiatric report he wrote following the examination, Dr. Hockman called Leslie Van Houten a spoiled little princess who was unable to suffer frustration and delay of gratification. From childhood on, she'd had extreme difficulties with impulse control. When she didn't get her way, she went into rages, for example, beating her adopted sister with a shoe. From a position of overall perspective, Hockman noted, it is quite clear that Leslie Van Houten was a psychologically loaded gun which went off as a consequence of the complex intermeshing of highly unlikely and bizarre circumstances. Hockman confirmed something I had long suspected. Of the three female defendants, Leslie Van Houten was the least committed to Charles Manson. She listened to Manson's talk of philosophy, but it wasn't her trip. Nor could she get that into Charlie sexually, and that bothered her a lot. "I couldn't get it on with Charlie like I could with Bobby," she said. According to Hockman, Leslie was obsessed with beauty. Bobby was beautiful. Charles was not, physically. Charles was short. That is something that always turned me off. Yet she killed at his command. Keith asked Hockman, "Doctor, did you ask her whether or not Mr. Manson, during her association with him, had any influence over her in her thought process and in her conduct and activity?" Answer, "She denies it, but I don't buy that." Question, "Why don't you buy that?" Answer, "Well, I don't understand why she would stay on the scene that long if there was nothing there for her, on some unconscious basis." As I'd observe in my final argument, many came to Spawn Ranch, but only a few stayed. Those who did so because they found the black-hearted medicine Manson was peddling very palatable. According to Hockman, in talking to him, Leslie professed a kind of primitive Christianity, love for the world, acceptance of all things. And I asked her, "Well, professing that, how can it be you would murder someone?" She said, "Well, that was something inside of me, too." Maxwell Keith should have stopped right there. Instead, he asked Hockman, "How do you interpret that?" Answer, "I think it's rather realistic. I think that in reality it was something inside of her, despite her chronic denial of the emotional aspects of herself, that a rage was there." Nor did Keith leave it at that. He now asked, "When you say a rage was there, what do you mean by that?" Answer, "In my opinion, it would take a rage, an emotional reaction, to kill someone. I think it is unquestionable that that feeling was inside of her." Question, "Bearing in mind that she had never seen or heard of Mrs. LaBianca, in your opinion, there was some hate in her when this occurred?" Answer, "Well, I think it would make it easier for her not to know Mrs. LaBianca. It is hard to kill someone that you have good feelings towards. I don't think there was anything specific about Mrs. LaBianca." Let me make myself clear. Mrs. LaBianca was an object, a blank screen upon which Leslie projected her feelings, much as a patient projects his feelings on an analyst whom he doesn't know. Feelings towards her mother, her father, toward the establishment. I think she was a very angry girl for a long time, a very alienated girl for a long time, and the anger and rage was associated with that. Hockman was articulating one of the main points of my final summation, namely that Leslie, Sadie, Katie, and Tex had a hostility and rage within them that pre-existed Charles Manson. They were different from Linda Kasabian, Paul Watkins, Brooks Poston, Juan Flynn, and TJ. When Manson asked them to kill for him, each said no. Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Leslie Van Houten said yes. So there had to be something special about these people that caused them to kill. Some kind of inner flaw. Apart from Charlie. Though he had badly damaged his own case, Keith had tried to put the hat on Manson. Fitzgerald, in his examination of Hockman, did just the opposite. He sought to minimize the importance of Manson's influence over Leslie. Asking Hockman what Manson's influence actually was, he received this reply. "His ideas, his presence, the role he played in his relationship to her, served to reinforce a lot of her feelings and attitudes. It served to reinforce and give her a way of continuing her general social alienation, her alienation from the establishment." Question. "So, really, all you were saying is that A, Manson could possibly have had some influence, and B, if he did have some influence, it would only contribute to the lowering of her restraints on her impulsiveness, is that correct?" Answer. "Yes." Question. "So any influence Manson had on Leslie Van Houten, in terms of your professional opinion, is tenuous at best, is that correct?" There was no meaningful dichotomy between Leslie Van Houten and Fitzgerald's client, Patricia Krenwinkel. Both young girls had joined the family, submitted to Manson's domination, and ultimately murdered for him. In trying to establish that Manson was not responsible for causing Leslie to kill, Fitzgerald was at the same time establishing that Manson wasn't responsible for Katie's killing either. Hockman's reply badly hurt not only Leslie, but Katie and Sadie as well. Answer. Let me give you another example that may make it clearer. Suppose someone comes in and says, "Let's eat the whole apple pie." Obviously, your temptation is stimulated by the suggestion, but your final decision on whether or not to eat the whole pie or just one piece comes out of you. So the other person is influential, but it is not a final arbiter or decider of that situation. Someone can tell you to shoot someone, but your decision to do that comes from inside you. Kenrick, when his turn came, picked up the scent. And so you are telling us then, in layman's language, that when someone takes a knife and stabs, the decision to do that is a personal decision. Answer. In the ultimate analysis, it is. Question. It is a personal decision of the person who does the stabbing. Answer. Yes. Ironically, Kenrick and I were now on the same side. Both of us were seeking to prove that, even independent of Manson, these girls had murder within them. Manson was very impressed by Huckman, and at first wanted to be interviewed by him. I was relieved, however, when he later abandoned the idea. I wasn't greatly worried about Manson conning Huckman. But even if Huckman didn't buy Manson's story, Kenrick would make sure he repeated it on the stand. Thus, using Huckman as a conduit, Manson could get almost everything he wanted before the jury without being subject to my cross-examination. Huckman found in all three girls much evidence in their history of early alienation, of early antisocial or deviant behavior. Even before joining the family, Leslie had more emotional problems than the average person. Sadie actively sought to be everything her father warned her not to be. She thinks now, in retrospect, Huckman noted, that even without Charles Manson, she would have ended up in jail for manslaughter or assault with a deadly weapon. Katie first had sex at 15. She never saw the boy again, and she suffered tremendous guilt because of the experience. Manson eradicated that guilt. He also, in letting her join the family, gave her the acceptance she desperately craved. Of the three, Huckman felt Sadie had a little more remorse than the other two. She often talked of wishing her life were over. Yet he also noted one is struck by the absence of a conventional sense of morality or conscience in this girl. And, he testified, she does not seem to manifest any evidence of discomfort or anxiety about her present circumstances, or her conviction and possible death sentence. On the contrary, she seemed to manifest a remarkable peacefulness and self-acceptance in her present state. According to Huckman, all three girls denied any sense of guilt whatever about anything, and he felt that intellectually, they actually believed there is no right or wrong, that morality is a relative thing. However, I, as a psychiatrist, know that you cannot rationally do away with the feelings that exist on the irrational, unconscious level. You cannot tell yourself that killing is okay intellectually when you have grown up all your life feeling that killing is wrong. In short, Huckman believed that as human beings the girls felt some guilt deep down inside, even though they consciously suppressed it. Keith asked Huckman, "In your opinion, doctor, would Leslie be susceptible or respond to intensive therapy?" Answer, possibly. Question, in other words, you don't feel that she is such a lost soul that she could never be rehabilitated? Answer, no, I don't think she is that lost a soul, no. To a psychiatrist, no one is beyond redemption. This is essential, standard testimony. Yet only one of the defense attorneys, Maxwell Keith, asked the question, and then only on redirect. Earlier I'd brought out that Huckman had only the word of the girls that they were on LSD either night. I now asked him, "Have you ever read a reported case in the literature of LSD of any individual who committed murder while under the influence of LSD?" Answer, no. Suicide, but not murder. As I'd later asked the jury, could Watson, Atkins, Krenwinkle, and Van Houten, all four, be exceptions? A large portion of Huckman's testimony had dealt with the mental states of the three girls. Susan Atkins was suffering from a diagnosable condition, he said, an early childhood deprivation syndrome which had resulted in a hysterical personality type. This was not legal insanity as defined by McNaughton. Leslie Van Houten was an immature, unusually impulsive person who tended to act spontaneously without reflection. Nor was this legal insanity as defined by McNaughton. In his report on Krenwinkel, Dr. Claude Brown, the Mobile psychiatrist, had stated that, "At the time I saw Miss Krenwinkel, she showed a schizophrenic reaction." He added, however, that "I do not state with any certainty that this psychosis existed at the time of the alleged murders." Schizophrenia may be legal insanity as defined by McNaughton, but Dr. Brown's opinion was qualified, and when Fitzgerald asked Dr. Hockman if, on the basis of his examination of Krenwinkel, he agreed that she was or had been schizophrenic, Hockman replied, "I would say no." It remained to bring these points across to the jury in terms they could easily understand. On re-cross-examination, I had Hockman define the word psychotic. He replied that it meant a loss of contact with reality. I then asked him, "At the present time, doctor, do you feel any of these three female defendants are psychotic?" Answer, "No." Question, "In your opinion, do you feel that any of these three female defendants have ever been psychotic?" Answer, "No." Bugliosi, "May I approach the witness, Your Honor? I want to ask the witness a question privately." The court, "Yes, you may." I had already questioned Dr. Hockman once about this, but I wanted to be absolutely certain of his reply. Once I had received it, I returned to the counsel table and asked him a number of unrelated questions so the jury wouldn't know what we had been talking about. I then gradually worked up to the big one. Question. "The term insanity, doctor, you are familiar with that term, of course?" Answer, "Yes." Question. "Basically, you define the word insanity to be the layman's synonym for psychotic?" Answer, "I would say that the word insanity is used generally to mean psychotic." Question. "Then from a psychiatric standpoint, I take it that in your opinion, none of these three female defendants are presently insane, nor have they ever been insane. Is that correct?" Answer, "That is correct." As far as the psychiatric testimony was concerned, with Hockman's reply, the ballgame was over. The defense called only three more witnesses during the penalty trial, all hardcore family members. Each was on the stand only a short time, but their testimony, particularly that of the first witness, was as shocking as anything that had gone before. Catherine Gillies, whose grandmother owned Myers Ranch, parroted the family line. "Charlie never led anyone. There was never any talk of a race war. These murders were committed to free Bobby Beausoleil." Coldly, matter-of-factly, the 21-year-old girl testified that on the night of the LaBianca murders, "I followed Katie to the car and I asked her if I could go with her. Linda, Leslie, and Sadie were all in the car, and they said that they had plenty of people to do what they were going to do and that I didn't need to go." On direct examination by Kenrick, Kathy stated, "You know, I am willing to kill for a brother. We all are." Question. "What do you mean by that?" Answer. "In other words, to get a brother out of jail, I would kill. I would have killed that night, except I did not go." Question. "What prevented you from going with them, if anything?" Answer. "Just the fact that they didn't need me." Apparently Fitzgerald hoped to soften the harshness of her reply when he asked her, "Have you killed anybody to get someone out of jail?" With a strange little smile, Kathy turned her head and, looking directly at the jury, replied, "Not yet." Kathy had testified on direct examination that Katie had told her about the Tate LaBianca murders. On cross-examination, I asked her, "When Katie told you that they had murdered these people, did this disturb you at all?"